CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. The Great Game, once upon a time, involved all of the states that we now see spinning around waiting for what comes next, that the Taliban has retaken Kabul and now declares the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. The Great Game. In the 19th century, it involved the British Empire. The first Anglo-Afghan War, dated 1839 to 1842, led to humiliation and defeat and massacre. The second Anglo-Afghan War, 1879 to 1880, also led to a defeat and humiliation. You will recall that Winston Churchill participated in his first bloodletting with riding against the Afridi. That was the Afghan War, Anglo-Afghan War, borderland with the subcontinent, the Raj, India. In 1919, again, the British Empire tangled with Afghanistan. Not record to follow, but the U.S. has just done so. Following the Soviet Empire's defeat or humiliation in Afghanistan, now the American Empire defeat and humiliation in Afghanistan. Lessons learned. The first lesson learned is that after these events, the U.S. will pay for it in terms of prestige. Gregory, a very good evening to you. What scale of prestige did Britain pay in the defeats of 1842, 1880, 1919? What did the Soviets pay in prestige in 1979 to 1989?
Well, one thing's for sure, the loss of strategic prestige costs a nation across the board in its dealings in matters even totally unrelated to the region in which the failure or humiliation occurred. So what we're seeing, what we saw with the collapse of the Soviet Union's activities in Afghanistan, which was not entirely the cause of the Soviet collapse, but it certainly came at a time when the Soviet Union was declining and imploding. But it really had a souring impact on the Soviet population itself, as well as on Soviet ability to project power. We are seeing the People's Republic of China rushing into this vacuum without heeding the reality that the collapse of the Chinese Empire or the graveyard of the Chinese Empire could also well become linked to the Afghan situation, because the People's Republic of China is now actively engaged and has been in supporting the Taliban because they extracted a promise from them that they wouldn't interfere, that the Taliban would not interfere in China, would not support the Muslim Turkic Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. So Beijing thinks, well, it's got an opportunity to make an inroad into Taliban controlled Afghanistan. It will pour a lot more money in there. It will try to exploit some of the mining resources there, mineral resources, but it will try more than anything else to get a new conduit down to the Indian Ocean through Afghanistan's Wakhan corridor and right across to Iran and down into the Persian Gulf and Indian Ocean. That may be slightly illusory because India itself will challenge that. And we have to take the point of view that the collapse of U.S. prestige in the way in which it handled its withdrawal from Afghanistan this month will impact India's belief in how it should proceed with the strategic relationship between New Delhi and Washington. What we're seeing is that the Quad alliance between India, Japan, the United States, and Australia is going to take on a new complexion. India will see itself as being less obliged to take advice from Washington on how to constrain the People's Republic of China, because that's what the Quad alliance is all about. So you will start to see India on a unilateral basis make decisions about how to handle China, the People's Republic of China, as Beijing moves into Afghanistan.
India has a challenge in Pakistan. We're told for some time, and I follow the reporting carefully, that the Taliban is a creature, it's a creation of the ISI, the state security, is particularly Directorate S, is said to be the bureau that runs Taliban recruiting, Taliban supplying along the border region between Pakistan and India. We're told the reason Pakistan commits itself to this policy is something called strategic depth, some idea that having Afghanistan to fall back on means that it is less likely that India would overwhelm the government in Islamabad and Rawalpindi in the first or second or third week of the war. I don't follow that, but I repeat it. I also note that the ISI has played both sides of this story. Sometimes they act as if they're vulnerable to Afghanistan tumbling into chaos. Other times they act as if it suits them to have Afghanistan in chaos. What's the version now? Is ISI pleased with this outcome?
Well, let's be straight about this. Anything you read about ISI, the Services Intelligence of Pakistan, is coming directly to you through the conduit of the Indian Research and Analysis Wing, the Indian Intelligence Service. The mythology about ISI is created in New Delhi. I've spent a lot of time with the senior personnel in ISI, including a couple of its directors general, and I also spent a lot of time in the 80s with President Zia-ul-Haq talking about this whole concept of strategic depth. And I can tell you that Zia and all of the people that I've met don't really think that Afghanistan provides Pakistan with the strategic depth it would like to have to protect itself from an Indian overwhelming land power invasion of Pakistan. There is nothing, including strategic depth, geographic depth, which will save Islamabad if the Indians come across the borders there and across the Punjab plains. Pakistan regards strategic depth as something which is acquired by mobility and technology, which is why it's looking at using its navy to give it some of that depth. It's looking at its counterforce nuclear weapons against Indian military forces to blunt their approach rather than to have to fall back on, say, Jalalabad and Kabul. The Pakistanis do not want to do that. They cannot do that. That's why the Pakistanis also manned the strategic missiles, which were based in Saudi Arabia, as a potential second strike capability against India. So Pakistan has flirted decades ago with this concept of geographic strategic depth and looking at Afghanistan, and I wrote extensively about that in the 70s and 80s. It is a mythical thing, and the Pakistanis recognize it as such. The reality is that ISI learned its lessons very, very early on in the war against the Soviets not to put its faith in the Pashtun tribal movements which generated the Taliban. This was not a creature of ISI. Quite the contrary, it became the bane of ISI's existence and continues to be so, whereas India's Research and Analysis Wing worked with these Pashtun extremist groups, including Taliban, for decades, actually providing them with weapons to go in and agitate in Pakistan's federally administered tribal areas to cause these troubles, which later spread back into Pastun proper. So, we've been fed a fairly deliberate line on ISI and on Pakistan. Pakistan is very worried about the collapse of the Afghan government. As much as it distrusted the government of President Ghani, it did not welcome a Taliban one. And it said, and all the officials have said to me, we will never again support the Pashtun at the isolation of the Dari-speaking or Persian-speaking Afghan groups. And I believe that they've persisted with that attempt to balance their relations. But they do have the problem of Taliban-prompted Pashtun coming across the border, linking with the Pashtun of Pakistan.
I'm told, Gregory, that the Afghanistan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban are two sides of the same coin. Is that useful? Is that metaphor helpful?
it's not helpful and it's not correct. Yes, they've had some connections, but the Pakistan Taliban, for want of a better word, was created by Pakistanis literally who were opposed to the government. And yes, they're a problem for the government, but they are not part of the Afghan Taliban. Could they be in the future? Well, absolutely. Have they had links? Yes, they have had contacts because they're all part of this, if you like, overarching Pashtun movement. But they're very different people, geographically divided as well as politically.
And you say that Pakistan now has to concern itself with radicalization across the border. Is that correct? They're the first target of a radicalized Afghanistan.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is what the Research and Analysis Wing of India was all consistently trying to do to make sure that radicalization came across the border and destabilized Pakistan. Pakistan's population, however, which is, as you know, about 40% Shia anyway, or a high percentage Shia, they have to balance Shia-Sunni relations, so they're not anxious to literally support an overwhelmingly Sunni Pashtun movement. They also have to keep calm, and they tend to worry more about things as to how to, if you like, create a stable situation along the Indus River Valley, which is the spinal cord of Pakistan going all the way down to the Indian Ocean, because unless they can keep some degree of calm, they will provide the excuse by having an uprising within Pakistan. They'll just provide the excuse for India to do what it is going to do sooner or later, which is attack from Kashmir, Indian-occupied Kashmir, across Azad Kashmir, the Pakistani-controlled Kashmir, and link up to the Wakhan corridor of Afghanistan and then over to Tajikistan. This would be disastrous for Pakistan. It would be even more disastrous for Beijing because it would cut off its land bridge down to the Indian Ocean.
I'm speaking with Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We're talking about the non-transparent fog of war situation in Afghanistan and throughout the region. I began by referencing the Great Game. That was a battle in 19th century. Over many years and involved diplomacy and threats and military commitment and in an enormous number of entanglements in Europe between Petersburg, then the capital of the Russian Empire, and London, the capital of the British Empire. Well, the players have moved around, but Russia's still there. So when we come back, what is the significance of the fall of Kabul to the Taliban for Moscow? I note that Moscow has kept its embassy open and is, in fact, talking about welcoming the Taliban. What does that mean for Russia's possibilities in Eurasia? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Basham.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.